Any questions to last lecture? Yeah.
So I have a question regarding the notation because I'm having trouble, I'm getting confused in that the equation, for example, the first equation there could mean several things, right? It could mean the derivative along the mu direction of the vector, of the covector ej, which has indices nu, so j would be a label of the covector, and that would only have Christoffel symbols, right? No spin connection. Or it could mean the covariant derivative of the nu vector in the ej basis, the field line, so that would have only omega indices. Or it could be the covariant derivative of this.
So we use nabla. For the space-time covariant derivative. So that will be always just involving the partial derivative and the Christoffel symbols. So at some point, for instance, I was writing, because that is minus E nabla E, and that meant that you only put the gamma. No, because here, as a partial derivative appearing and a gamma appearing.
So, so can I have the capital D and gamma here both?
So yeah, so the capital D. So I defined it in a way which would involve gamma. I mean, which would involve the partial derivative. Then gamma for each spacetime index. And an omega for each internal index. So if you don't have a spacetime index, then only omega appears. So I have not defined any symbol for take only the omegas and not the gammas. Such a thing I haven't even defined.
So let me rephrase my question. What if I want to compute the covariant derivative? So the field line, it started its existence as four orthogonal vectors, right?
Yeah, or three.
Three orthogonal vectors. So what if I want to compute the covariant derivative along the mu direction of one of those vectors? You see where the...
Yeah, so this would be nabla.
That would be nabla.
If you just say, I don't care that it's a frame, that would be, you know, that it's just a vector, a spacetime vector, then it would be nabla.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But if you want to have specific properties, for instance, more or less this defines you the spin connection as a function of gamma and the triad. yeah, then you need to introduce this omega. No. To make things compatible with respect to translating between these two indices. Okay. Yeah, so so the notation, again, nabla is just, does only know about gamma. D here will mean to apply the gamma for each spacetime index. And for each internal index, you need one omega. More questions? so last time we did derive, we used this compatibility condition to derive the expression for the spin connection in terms of the triads and the or co-triads and the Christoffel symbol. So then you can actually contract this equation again with the triad or co-triad, and you find also the Christoffel symbol as a function of the spin connection. So now let's forget for a moment that the spin connection is fixed. we can look at this relation and ask, what does need omega to satisfy so that gamma is actually the Levi-Civita connection? And the Levi-Civita connection is specified uniquely by these two conditions. Torsion freeness and metricity. So basically we asked, what does omega need to satisfy? So that gamma is Levi-Civita, and this is metricity, which basically says that the derivative of the metric, or also the inverse metric, vanishes, and torsion freeness, which has an expression in terms of that's a derivative of the covariant derivative of a scalar is just a partial derivative, but in terms of the Levi-Civita symbol, it means that the lower indices are symmetric. And we can still use this equation because this equation connects omega and gamma. So it gives you these two equations. I mean, these two equations are equivalent. So, so we can actually start with metricity. And I will use that. That this is zero. So that means, according to our definition of this covariant derivative with a capital D, I don't have any internal index, so capital D in this case is equal to nabla. So this is zero. And so that's these two things we start from. And we know that d mu e nu k is also zero. That's our compatibility equation. So because these things are zero, then we know that mu nu g mu nu is also vanishing because here you just apply the Leibniz rule for having this as a covariant derivative of acting on the first factor, then on the second factor, and then on the third factor. And so all these terms vanish according to the above. And you can basically see that this is indeed the compatibility condition, because what we do is to translate these two indices, spacetime indices, into internal indices. And by definition of our tetrad at some point, this is just the Kronecker delta. And so now you have something with just two internal indices. So here we would apply the definition of our D on acting on internal indices. So this is the partial derivative, where I can still write the partial derivative of something which is constant in spacetime is zero. And I think then it's plus omega mu need a no index. delta Lg plus omega G mu L delta K. And so here is just the definition of d mu. And so here we see this needs to vanish because this expression vanishes. And so we conclude that now I need to be a bit careful. If we pull up one index with of the spin connection, so if I pull up the index, it will always be to the right of this upper index. If I pull down this index, it will be before the lower index. And it's important because it's exactly a sign. So I define this to be KL DLJ. So this needs to be anti-symmetric in KJ. That's basically what this equation tells you. So metricity is of gamma is antisymmetry in the internal indices of omega. And of course, you can see this already. This has to vanish. This is the internal metric. So this condition in itself is a internal metricity of condition for d mu. So the capital D connection or the capital D derivative satisfies both that it annihilates the internal metric and the spacetime metric. Okay. So the other point was torsion. Again, we will basically start from our compatibility equation there or there. So we know that the covariant derivatives of our triad vanishes. And so also an antisymmetric combination vanishes. Okay, and now I just write out the definition of these two terms. So there's a space-time derivative. And the omega, the spin connection terms. I have not ordered it in the best way, but you see here, you have exactly the gamma appearing. With an anti-symmetric combination here. of your lower indices. So if you have a, and you just contract one of this upper index with an internal index. So actually, this is exactly torsion. You could, if you define torsion as a T mu nu, which is a bad name because T stands usually there for something else, or Tj mu nu here. contract this index with this one. So we define actually torsion of the spin connection. So that's the definition as the rest of the terms, because they have to cancel each other if the compatibility holds. So that's all these two terms. Plus the spin connection terms. And this we know because this has to be vanishing that this is equal to the anti-symmetrization of the Levi-Civita connection contracted with gamma j with the triad, co-triad. So this is really definition, torsion tensor. If you ever come around and express everything in terms of frame bundles, then you have an anti-symmetrized partial derivative here, acting on a one form. So it's actually an exterior derivative. But then you can also put a omega there, so that in terms of forms, it's you can write it as d omega e. And so it has also some name like Katang first fundamental form or second. J. And this defines you a two form. Yeah. Mu nu, so that's a two form, antisymmetric two form with an index, with an internal index. Okay, so we do get a torsion free spin connection if this is actually zero. Okay. And interestingly, I mean, interestingly, if you do metric Palatini, which is also first order formalism, you do have the metric as independent variable, and you have gamma as an independent variable. But what you put in there is that gamma is torsion free. So gamma is a symmetric, not tensor because it's not a tensor, but you you put actually in into your action principle that gamma has symmetric lower indices. What we will do later is to keep the triads as independent variables and the spin connection as independent variables. But we will already build in that omega is antisymmetric in this internal indices. So we build in this internal metricity. And what we allow is actually torsion. And then we will get an equation of motion which tells you that torsion is vanishing. So if you have seen first order Palatini in metric variables, there is one equation of motion which tells you that gamma needs to be metric. And before we do that, we do something else, because we did this entire exercise to eventually write the Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of these variables. So the Einstein-Hilbert action includes a Ricci scalar. So we need to figure out what is a curvature tensor in terms of our spin connection. And so to do that, I will go back to the definition of the Riemann tensor. Anyone remembers what the geometric interpretation of the Riemann tensor was?
The commutator of the Laplace?
Yeah. So, of course, there's lots of conventions for the Riemann tensor. So that's the first time I tell you how I actually define the Riemann tensor. The covariant derivative and here I let it act on a covector and so the covector I do express as my co-frame field with basic coefficients Vj. So I would need to write this, if I use that, I write this all with my fully covariant derivative, because by definition, again, if D acts on the product, I would not see I would not use any omega because I've contracted the internal index, but then I can use the Leibniz rule and I apply that to this term and this term, and then I would come up with some omegas. So I can write this. Then I use this compatibility equation for the capital D's. So you can just pull Ej out. And then you just apply the definition, the first covariant derivative of the nu here, and now I get tired of writing all these things explicitly. So that's the first covariant derivative, then we put the second covariant derivative. Anyway, I give you the result because it's not terribly interesting. So you get partial derivatives acting on your omegas, and then you get a term quadratic in the omegas. So this is very similar to actually if you express the Riemann tensor in terms of gammas, you get also an antisymmetric term in the partial derivative of gamma, and then you get a combination of two gamma terms, of terms which involve two gammas. This is V, again, the covector V sigma. I write it in this way because I have a V sigma here, so I know all this is my Riemann tensor. So it's a square bracket contracted with a triad and a co-triad. So we define the square bracket as a curvature tensor F. So we use this F, which is also used in Young-Mills. For a reason, because this is exactly the same formalism as you would have in Young-Mills, where F is everything in the square bracket. And so if you express R, it's a contraction of the Riemann Ricci tensor, which is a contraction of the Riemann tensor. And so you go through all the contractions, which you can write G, you can write with a triads or co-triads, and find that this is the curvature tensor contracted with two triads. Ah. Okay, so we will need this. At some point. So also I say triad, everything was actually for general dimensions. You could have applied it to 4D, even 2D mostly. But now we are going to do something which is basically only possible in 3D. And it refers to what I was explaining earlier, that the spin connection had these two properties, metricity, which was encoded in the antisymmetry of the internal indices, and torsion freeness. So we actually now enforce The anti-symmetry in these two indices, so this is omega delta J L L K. By writing this as a Levi-Civita symbol in the internal indices. So at some point, well, I didn't cover it because you said you had it at some, or Aldo might have talked about tensor densities. That applies to the Levi-Civita symbol if you write it with spacetime indices. So here we have internal indices, and the internal matrix is just the Kronecker delta, so I don't need to write any tensor density thing. So I actually introduce new objects which just have one index. By enforcing the anti-symmetry of the spin connection. And that works because we're actually in three dimensions. And an anti-symmetric index pair has three components in three dimensions. So you can replace that. So similarly, we had F mu nu jk. So this you can also write as GLK FL menu. So then we can define all these various quantities we had before. So a covariant derivative of, say, a covector, internal covector is now given by this epsilon contracted with one index spin connection. The torsion as a curvature tensor is now given in terms of the partial derivatives. Here you have this one index, and here you had an antisymmetric combination, and this antisymmetric combination is again enforced by applying the epsilon tensor. Okay, and the last thing is a torsion tensor. And that apparently gives that. okay, why do we do that? So now we have objects both the triads and the spin connection just come with one internal index. it's three-dimensional. Then we have this epsilon appearing. And in the end, what will happen is that we can contract this three-dimensional index with a D-algebra index for SU2 or for SO3. And the epsilons which appear turn out to be, well, they are the structure, so-called structure constants of the Lie algebra. So this allows us to express everything with Lie algebra valued forms in principle. And that gives you really the, that makes explicit SU2 symmetry. But yeah, this applies. It only applies if you want to have everything in abstract forms, but if you don't know what all this means, it doesn't matter because we will write everything quite explicitly. Okay, so now we can come back to expressing our Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of our new objects. And we can again already use our definition or our trick, which is introducing epsilon everywhere to change two indices, a pair of antisymmetric indices into one index. By the way, here, this by definition is an antisymmetric tensor in JK. You can check that explicitly. So we have this as a contraction with two cotriads of our tensor, and we write our tensor now with an epsilon. So this now actually evaluates to something nicely. But I don't know if you know. So this is actually a nice formula for the inverse of a matrix, which I will explain in a second. And so the inverse of this, this seen as a matrix, the inverse of this matrix is, well, if I write this internal index up and this index down, and in this formula for this inverse, there's also a determinant factor, because it actually comes from the determinant formula, e rho m, and the minus sign comes from some permutation you have to do to apply this formula. And I write a tilde here. That's the Levi-Civita tensor, the Levi-Civita tensor density. So I write a tilde to remind you that this is a tensor density. And you are not allowed to completely freely just pull up and down indices with a matrix, because if you do that, there is a determinant factor of G, which you need to put in. So this turns out to be all this. Everyone is looking very mysteriously. So this follows from an identity. If I write it just with, say, in this case, I can write it for an M by N matrix, but I will just write it for a 3x3 matrix. So it's a general expression for the inverse of a matrix. Any clue where this comes from? Have you seen that? It's appear to you.
And it looks like when you're invert matrices, and I mean the formula for the determinant involves odd permutation of the matrix.
Yeah. So this comes on this you can indeed prove. I mean, I've seen that in some way in your linear algebra, but then it was kind of some funny rule like Cramer's rule, and you have not written it in this way. If you would write it in this general way, it would be just this. And it comes more or less from a definition of a, you can show this formula. Now I write it with a general dimensions or general n by n matrix. The determinant of a matrix is defined as an anti-symmetrization of all the rows or all the columns. so you can choose here any permutations of the B's, but depending on the sign of the permutation, you get a sign. But if you do this contraction, then this result is also anti-symmetric. So the sign is actually encoded in this epsilon here on the right-hand side. so this is, oh, sorry. This is a formula for the determinant of a matrix. Now you just contract that with an inverse matrix, and you get the formula above. So I have applied it here. And just that, even if I write it with a tilde, this is just a Levi-Civita symbol, just written with other indices. And this is also just a Levi-Civita symbol, just written with other indices. and so you get this result. This is the determinant factor. Okay, so we find, and it's actually nice if we get the determinant factor, because this is a determinant of E rho mu is what in terms of the metric? So two E's with index down give you G mu nu. So if you take the determinant, you get of this, you get determinant of square root of G, because you have just one E. And there's some, you use that the determinant of A times B is a determinant of A times determinant of B. And you get the inverse here. So we don't need to care about the determinant of G. Well, that would have been anyway easy. We get this minus sign, interestingly, which we will ignore soon, but. And we get this tensor Levi-Civita thing. And so finally, I can just express all my Einstein-Hilbert action. Just in this way. And indeed, I need to integrate over its densities. That's why I have a square root of G. So the density is, in fact, just encoded in writing this epsilon here. And this is again. Well, this is anti-symmetric. this is also anti-symmetric. You take an anti-symmetric contraction of these two objects. This is a covector or a one form. This is an anti-symmetric covector of rank two or something. So it's a two form. You take an anti-symmetric product. So this actually turns out to be just a wedge product of E wedge F. And you contract these two indices if you want to write it fancy as Lie algebra index objects. There would be just a trace of this. But so typically you save here writing lots of indices, but you forget what all these things mean. And it's a bit harder to reconstruct all the prefectors and signs. Okay, so we did this entire exercise because I claimed this is a much simpler action, and it's easy to see the equations of motion. So here indeed, let me start something new. So at some point, actually to match some standard definitions of things, I will introduce a factor of 1/2 and drop the minus sign. Write again this action explicitly. so because of the redefinition, there's a slight definition here of these factors. so it's a very simple action, and so in some sense, because we treat E as an independent variable. And this is the omega with one index. But also in this formula of F, there's no E appearing. So if I vary with respect to this action, with respect to E, you just get that F is equal to zero. So epsilon tilde is just the Levi-Civita symbol, so that's just a constant entry.
Don't we have an E in the in the potential in the determinant factor? And, like if we
here, you mean?
Yeah.
No. So if you so this is just defined to be the totally anti-symmetric tensor. So you get an E if, no, you don't even get an E if you do coordinate transformation, because then you get just a determinant of your coordinate transformation. So this is really just a defined to be plus one for this entry and minus one for an odd permutation.
If we keep the indices, if we try to put them
down. Yeah, if you would pull them down, but I write it this, you know, I mean, it's defined in this way. If I would pull them down, I have to pull them up here.
And there is no.
And if, yeah, so if I would pull them down, actually, I haven't. Anyway, this so this would be G epsilon sigma mu nu. So now whole lambda tau nu. So this, according to the formula above, actually this does give you a determinant of G factor. So to not get the determinant of G factor, you have to take the inverse. And so that is, in my definition, this is again just defined to be epsilon 1, 2, 3 equal to plus 1. But so one thing is that you cannot just put these indices down without with the metric and not introducing also this factor. So if you do that, you would have to be careful to introduce this metric factor, but then they all cancel out. So actually, if you use this form language, then in fact the integral, you would not, you know, then everything is taken care of by this formalism, and yet then you never see actually this epsilon. And you don't write any integration symbols because they are already in the form, in the understanding of F as a two form and E as a one form. And if you have a three form, it just naturally integrates. So we can here treat epsilon tilde, you can basically just ignore for the variation. It's some constant here. And so this only depends on omega. So if you do vary this, you get just that the curvature vanishes. Now omega variation with respect to omega is slightly more involved, but not too much. Again, if you write it in terms of forms, F would be d omega omega. You make an integration by parts, and it is then d omega e, and d omega e was the torsion. So if you don't write it in forms, you write this object out. This object has some partial derivatives on the omegas. You do integration by parts with respect to these partial derivatives. They end up on the e, and you collect all terms, and then you get the definition of your torsion tensor. So as promised, we do get as an equation of motion torsion freeness of the spin connection. Metricity we imposed explicitly is by introducing this epsilon. And the other equation is F is equal to zero. Okay. So in fact, this term E which F, how can you see that? It's almost directly something which you could say it's Q times P, just that we use it in a different form. So it will also be a very convenient form for our canonical analysis, which we will do, I guess, next week. What we will do in the next lecture is to look at the symmetries of the action. And I will first present some the Noether theorem, but maybe the Noether theorem, it's the so-called second Noether theorem that applies to actions with gauge symmetries. which is different from the first Noether symmetry, but much more powerful. and then we will discuss the symmetries of this action. And from counting the symmetries, we will already see that, we will again see that this is a topological theory. yeah. And I will start that, I guess, in the next lecture. Any more questions to this one? Yeah.
So the fact that we're in three dimensions is because it's easier to get to transform our matrix that symmetric to a vector, but like. In four dimension, is it? Couldn't we get like go to the Lorentz group and we'll try to find?
So it's a good question, but it's unfortunately not the case. For those of you who do the Trans-Siemens thing, from here you can also just go to Trans-Siemens, but you introduce yet another connection, and this connection. It's the affine group, here would be the Euclidean group. So in this case, you introduce a connection which is omega for half the components and actually the triad for the other half of the components. So the triad itself will be a connection, but then you get another action, which is a Trans-Siemens action. Which looks actually a bit more complicated than the EF action, than this action. So this action is much simpler that you see directly it's topological. And then the Trans-Siemens action is how is it written? That if you do Euclidean, it would be a bigger group, because it would be rotations times R3. So that's in 3D, but in 4D, indeed, you can do the same thing. But there will be there's two differences. So you could do the same thing introducing tetrads. There's one big difference that S will not just be E, F, but which will be E veg E, and I think there's something like called a Hodge dual, if I'm not wrong, veg F. So here you get actually two E's, and so you don't get F equal to zero. The other difference in 4D is that in 3D, it's 3D, and SO3 is also three-dimensional, which nicely matches that you can actually take the Lie algebra indices as space-time indices. And 4D is 4D dimensional, surprisingly. But SO4 is six-dimensional. So if you can work with SO4, in fact, this you can write an action which is similar to 3D action, which is B veg F, which is topological, but B has two indices, which run from this anti-symmetric, which run from 1 to 4, and this gives you actually SO4 also for some reason. But then you have to constrain that B, to get gravity, you have to constrain that this is E veg E. So this makes your life much more complicated. And the other trick, which is done in and with the Ashika variables, LQG, and so on, is that you first gauge fix, or you go to time gauge. That basically allows you to go in the internal space back to 3D, and then you again work with SU2. So that's why I say it in 3D, it will be an SU2 gauge theory. And 4D, it's basically essentially also SU2. And sometimes it's some models you might see SO4. SO4 modulo some Z2 factoring. Okay, so it's not exactly correct because there's some Z2 factors. It's actually two SO3s. I don't know which roughly you could see in this equation. It's not very obvious. So there's actually infinitely, well, not infinitely, there's many playing things you can do. But in fact, the pain and pleasure of 4D is that this is six-dimensional, and you have just four-dimensional space. So you cannot do exactly the same. You can look at different generalizations, which give you always slightly different things. Okay, and then going back to, so that's the key issue in spin forms, to impose that. That is the key problem or problematic, if you want to. And it leads to lots of interesting things. which in 3D all are much more easier to address. So in fact, in 4D, interestingly, it seems that working with here you have something like a two form, and working with two forms that is areas instead of lengths is more natural. Whereas in 3D, you really get lengths as a fundamental variable. Okay. So I will assume at some point that you have roughly understood the spin connection and the triads, and so that finished the introduction of these variables. And the next lecture, I will talk about the symmetries. I'm not sure how long that will take. And after that, I do a short review into canonical formalism, and we go into really the constraint analysis, and that will then go into quantization. Okay, thank you.